Accession number 34702.
Real one.
Eric Denham, real one. Eric, can you tell me where and when you were born, please?
Yes, I was born in Pontefract, Yorkshire, 2nd of May 1922.
And can you tell me a little bit about your family background?
Yes, my father was serving in the army at the time, and my mother was a local from Pontefract. My grandparents lived in Pontefract, my maternal grandparents, and my paternal grandparents lived in Brighouse in Yorkshire.
What was your father serving with?
He was serving with the York and Lancaster Regiment, and he went on to serve right through the war and ended up as a major with the York and Lancaster Regiment. Died in 1983, I think.
So, did you move around?
Yes. We moved from there to Hampshire, Borden Camp. From there to Northern Ireland, back again to Portsmouth, then to India for 4 years in 1934. Arriving back in this country, December 1938.
So can you tell me about that time that you spent in India as...
Yes. First place was a place called Camp T, which was close to Nagpur, which is the biggest town. And we lived in cantonment, of course. The schools were run by the Army, Army Educational Corps. In the summertime, when the heat was quite fierce, the families used to move up to the hill station. We went to a place called Pachmari, and then we'd come back down again in the about September time. The battalion then moved on to a place called Ahmednagar in the central provinces, not too far from Pune. And that's where we left from. Well, when the 1938 crisis blew up, then things started changing a bit, and the battalion was due to come back to the UK anyway. But it was the practice in those days that the men, the troops, the whole battalion disembarked at Port Sudan to do a year's unaccompanied in Khartoum while the families then came on to the UK.
Can I ask you about that period in India as well, about, you know, your education? Because you said obviously it was within the army schools. What was that like as an education?
Well, it was quite broad, I suppose, although we didn't have all the amenities that they had in this country, and a lot depended upon the calibre of the Army Education Corps teachers. I had quite a good one, a chap called Huxford, and I learned a lot, and I was inquisitive myself. I was a great reader, and I read a lot of books, and I learned a lot that way. So I was self-taught to some extent, but helped by him.
And what about the living conditions when you were in the cantonments? What were things for the family like?
Well, quite good, really, I suppose, compared with what it was like in this country at the time. We had a bungalow. We had three servants. We had a cook, a bearer, and a gardener. And it was the practice then that the working day finished at lunchtime. It was too hot to work in the afternoon, so it was generally accepted that well, the parents certainly went to bed, but the children, of course, carried on doing what they would normally do. And that was it. There's a cinema in the local town that we used to go to by bus. We could catch a bus to go there. Other than that, we just made our own enjoyment. Church. I was in the choir and carried the cross at the time. And the time just seemed to go by, I suppose.
Was it a stipulation that, obviously, as army families, you had to attend church on a Sunday?
The troops did, yes. And as they did in this country at that time, there was a church parade every Sunday and troops would march to church and the Roman Catholics and Jews would fall out and the others were going to church. But in India it was slightly different because they took their rifles into church because of the, it was said to be because of the effect of the Indian mutiny, that they were caught out when that happened. So forever after that they took the rifles into church, which was unusual.
And did you as children play any sports at all out in India?
Yes, I played hockey quite a lot, yes. Which was, of course, a local Indian game, yes. Mm.
So you returned as a family, did you, with your father?
My father disembarked at Port Sudan and went on to Khartoum. We came back home. In those days, the army didn't provide anywhere to live if you weren't actually with the parent. So for a while we stayed with my maternal grandfather in Pontefract, and then because the battalion, when it came back, was going to go to York, to Fulford Barracks. Married quarters were allotted in Fulford Barracks, so we moved in to there, which was fine until the war broke out, and then we were kicked out again. So my mother had to rent a house in York, in Scarcroft Road, which is where we lived there while my father was still away, of course.
And how did your education carry on then, at that point? Were you still under sort of the army umbrella?
No, I'd finished my education then, and I was working. I got a job working with William Birch and Sons, builders and civil engineering contractors, in the office. Originally in Pontefract, and then I moved to York, where their headquarters were, and I had a job in York as well with them. They were building civil engineering works like sewerage stations and that sort of thing.
Did they get involved in sort of war work though, or building?
Yes. When the war started, the immediate job that they were given was building roadblocks. All the major roads had roadblocks built, one piece one side and one the other, and then a gap in between to come to. And there was a lot of that done all over the cities and towns.
What were the roadblocks sort of constructed of?
Was concrete it? Or bricks, dependent, mainly concrete. Yeah.
Was that dependent on what was available in the area?
I expect so, yes, yes.
Can I ask about, obviously, with the coming of the war, because you mentioned there was trouble in 1938 when the battalion came back from...
Yeah.
With the Munich crisis, I'm assuming. But at that point, Eric, did you have any thoughts on the situation in Europe in the late 1930s?
Not really, no. No. I have to admit, at that age, I was, 18, something like that. No. I don't suppose the thought ever crossed my mind, no.
And do you have memories of obviously the outbreak of war there?
Yes, I remember the air raid sirens going off and the announcement by Chamberlain on the radio quite clearly, yes. And after that, it seemed, well, what war? It was the phony war, I suppose they called it, didn't it? And then nothing, well, I mean, we were, as I said, we were kicked out of the married quarters, and we lived in this house, and I just got this job, and that was it. And of course then conscription and came in, that sort of thing, so I knew I would have to join up something eventually. And my mother was left on her own, as it were, with two other children. And my father was away. I was head of the household, as it were. So I waited till I was called up in 1941. And I went to Padgate, RAF Padgate, for interviews. And volunteered for air crew. And because I volunteered for air crew, and so had a lot of other people, there was a sort of block in the training facilities. And so they sent me home for 6 months, deferred service.
So had you made the decision to volunteer for the RAF and air crew?
Yes.
Was there any reasoning behind that? Why was that your choice?
Well, I'd seen the army. I'd grown up in the army. I didn't want to be foot slogging everywhere around the world. So I thought I would choose the Air Force.
Did your father have anything to say about it?
He wasn't there. He was abroad. I forget where he was exactly now, but he was somewhere in the Middle East.
So you decided then on the... Was the Navy an option?
No. I was never keen on the sea. Going out to India was a 3-week voyage. We hit the mother of all storms in the Bay of Biscay on the way out. Everybody was sick, including all the crew, except my father, I think. And I never really liked the sea all that much after, although I didn't suffer from seasickness anymore after that. It rather cured it, I think. So the Navy was never an option then.
So did you have to obviously make the effort prior to being called up to go and volunteer for the RAF rather than waiting for them to allot
you
something?
Oh, yes.
How did you go about doing that?
I can't remember. I think you did it through the Labour Exchange, I think, in those days. You could express a preference for, you know, whichever service, and as always, they're always wanting people to volunteer for air crew, although in actual fact they got to, I suppose, rather too many in the long term, as will be shown later on when I go further on in my
career. When you'd volunteered, though, obviously, did you have to have some form of medical and a sort of selection interview or something?
Well, I had this interview at Padgate, yes, when they sent me back home again. I was accepted for aircrew training.
Were they looking for anything when they were sort of interviewing you, do you think?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I was unfortunate in a way that I had no qualification, no paper qualifications, because of the type of education I'd received. But they seemed fairly happy with what I knew and the questions they were asking me and that sort of thing.
And was that accompanied by a medical as well at that time?
Yes.
Was that, what form did that take? Were they looking again for specific things for aircrew?
No, not at that time, I don't think, no. That came later on, yes.
And at that point, you said that, because obviously there was a bottleneck in the system, were you then sent back home and continued your employment, did you?
Well, yes, for a short while, but when I came back and I informed them what was happening and I would be leaving in 6 months, they terminated my employment anyway. So I was in fact out of work for 2 or 3 months before I eventually went to ACRC, Lord's Cricket Ground in London, in April 1942, when the call came.
So tell me about going down to Lord's.
Yes, that was quite interesting, really, because they'd taken over St John's Wood, the flats there, and Regent's Park Zoo was taken over. That was where we used to go to feed. And it was quite intensive. It was, I think I went there on the 12th of April, 1942, and left on my birthday, the 2nd of the 5th, 42. So, and in that time, you were issued with normal kit, including webbing and all that sort of ridiculous stuff, and full flying kit and all the rest of it, jabbed up to the eyebrows, that sort of thing. And then I was sent to Scarborough, number 11, the initial training wing at Scarborough, for my initial training.
So at Lord's, were you introduced to sort of like drill at all?
No, there was no time for any of that. It was getting kit, getting inoculated.
So it's just an induction, is it? That and very
films
very
on VD and all that sort of thing, of course. Put a great score on those days. And that was really somewhere to go to, I think, for everybody to go to get the, everything they needed and then go to their first training.
When you were issued with your kit at Lord's as well, were you given instruction on how to, you know, essentially wear it and put it on? Was there somebody there who would help you?
Not really, no. I mean, we had to learn that later on at the ICW. It was just all stuffed in a couple of kit bags, really. That was it, apart from putting on a uniform, and we had to pack up our civilian clothes and hand them in, and they were sent back home for us.
So where were you sent to with your first, with the initial training with?
Scarborough, 11 ITW Scarborough, which was, there were three wings in Scarborough, in fact, 11, 10, 11 and 17. So Scarborough was pretty full of aircrew cadets. And
where were you?
They lived in hotels. Hotels were taken over. I forget the name of the hotel now. It was on the front, and the rooms were, what would have been a single room, you know, was turned into a room for 3 or 4 people, that sort of thing. And the old hotels were turned over with a guard room downstairs. The Grand and places like that were all involved. And we embarked on this training then, which did quite a lot of PT, of course. We did a lot of drill, including in the early days, which is now pretty common with this, where you do continuity drill without any words of command. You know, you learn a routine. And then used to go down to the spa then for lectures on navigation, meteorology, principles of flight, all that sort of thing.
What kind of level did they take you to at that very initial stage with the lectures?
Well, fair level, yes. I mean, I wouldn't like to say we were experts, but we had to learn the principles and then the main things about MET, because, well, mind you, meteorology was in not particularly advanced in those days. And Morse code, we had to learn Morse code and be able to send it at a certain speed and receive at a certain speed.
So can I ask you with the MET then, what was the sort of, what was the kind of levels that you had to learn? What were the types of things you had to learn? I'm thinking at that very early
clouds,
stage.
Types of clouds, what precipitation, types of precipitation, emphasis was placed also on things like contrails, where conditions were such that you promote contrails in the sky, like you do today in the blue sky. You can see sometimes where aircraft have gone, those sort of things. Nothing in great detail, no climatology at that stage, of course, just basic met stuff.
And you mentioned the principles of flight. Again, what kind of level did you go to at that stage?
Just the initial ones, you know, theory of lift and drag and thrust and all the rest of it, and how an aeroplane flew, how the wing worked, that sort of thing.
And you also mentioned with Morse code. How was your training with Morse code conducted? How do they teach you, basically?
Well, initially we had to sort of just learn up the code itself, and then we had rooms where you put on the headphones and they sent, it was usually in blocks, code blocks, and we would have to write them all down, and they'd be checked over afterwards. And you had to work up to a certain speed limit, not anything like the speed that a wireless operator would operate, but up to a certain level. And also how to use that using the oldest lamp as well, by flashing the Morse code.
So would you actually have a sort of kit, a Morse key to practice on?
That's right, to send, yes.
And who was
sent to each other. And
were there instructors monitoring what you were doing?
Oh yes, yes, yes. Yes, they would check the results and let us know if we made errors, which we did obviously initially, but we got better as time went on.
And you mentioned you had to, did you have to reach a certain level of being able to receive and send Morse at that point?
Yes, I can't remember what the figures were, but they're fairly modest compared with what the regular operators would use.
So at that stage it's just for all air crew to really get a grasp of what Morse was.
That's right, yes. And navigation, we would be taught navigation, the basics of navigation, drawing, like, you know, track on the chart and wind errors and wind corrections and variation and all these other things that come into it. And we'd have to do plots, which would be given information on a flight, and then we'd have to plot this on the chart. And work out how, you know, get to the destination, in other words. Although we were going to be, I was initially a UC pilot, I still had to do the navigation, of course.
And I'm assuming that obviously things have changed so much now with things like GPS plotting and that.
Yes.
Was it quite primitive in a sense, what you had
to
work
out? It was very basic, yes. Because you didn't have the aids that you have nowadays, or, well, I mean, GPS, as you say now, but in wartime you weren't going to have a lot of aids. You weren't have any aids, in fact, apart from Astro or something like that, which the navigator could operate, or pinpointing things on the ground, if you could see the ground, and then making any corrections from that.
So the navigation that you did, obviously, at the initial training wing, I take it as well, these were all essentially lectures and paper records,
Yes.
Did you have lectures on, I'm thinking of maybe the sort of RAF hierarchy or organisation, so you would understand where
Yes, we did, in? Yes, we did, yes, yes. We had the history of the RAF, as it were, from 1918, as far as it went, and but not a great deal in that, no. That, and more of that later on.
How did your sort of, you know, can you give me a sense for what your kind of daily routine was at Scarborough?
Well, it would vary, of course, but normally there'd be a drill session of some time. There'd be all these lectures. There'd be PT down on the sands as well, And that would be about it. The drill, as I said, yes. We'd always have drill. And we'd march everywhere we went, of course. That was about it, I think. There was nothing.
What about your rations and food at the time?
I don't remember, really. I think we were fairly adequately fed, probably better than the civilians, I don't know. I mean, we were subject to rationing, obviously, like everybody else, but I don't remember too much about it, the food, because, you know, it was food and that was it.
And there was enough, because obviously you're involved in quite a lot of physical activity with the drill and the PT.
Yes, generally speaking, I was, yes.
And were you allowed out in the evenings at all?
Yes. We were allowed out in the evenings. We'd go to the cinema or something like that. And I think we had the RAF band there once and gave us a concert and that sort of thing. I remember the things that stay in your mind seem quite consequential, really, but the first time I ever heard the Warsaw Concerto was by the RAF band, which was giving a concert.
How long were you at Scarborough then?
Well, I left there then on September 1942, so I was there for nearly 5 months, I suppose, yes.
And was that a good grounding, obviously, for the very sort of basics of your RAF training?
Yes, I mean, you were then an airman, and you knew how to look after yourself and your uniform and polish your buttons every day, and same with your webbing, although why we had to have webbing as air crew, we never really knew, but... And, of course, regular haircuts and that sort of thing, and, you know, keep smart, and we were inspected, of course, regularly on parade. And that was about it, really. We were airmen.